hour to find a target. A bearded man in an expensive leather jacket came out of the station and began walking down the street, heading towards Louisiana Avenue. Zoya rose to her feet and followed, lagging just behind him while maintaining good situational awareness. The man spoke on his cell phone and pulled a black leather Tumi rollerboard behind him. He stopped at a street corner with several people waiting there in the dark for the signal to change, and Zoya moved next to him. She had trained in picking pockets ever since she was a little girl, so she knew what she was doing. First, she'd profiled him as a man carrying cash, and she'd already identified the location of his large folding wallet in his inside right coat pocket. In addition, the man was focused on his phone call, making him an easier mark. At the corner, he kept talking, his eyes on the crossing sign while he waited there. Attention steers perception, Zoya had been trained. The man wasn't thinking about the wallet inside his jacket, nor the woman standing next to him. She nonchalantly moved in front of him, squeezing tight through the group of people standing there, from his right to his left, and while she brushed close in the small crowd, her left hand rose, snaked inside his jacket, raised the wallet from the pocket, and smoothly lowered it out of his jacket and down to her waist. She never even slowed down. A block and a half away, she checked her loot. As she expected, the wealthy-looking man in the leather jacket was a fan of cash. There were three crisp $100 bills, a small fold of 20s, and a few fives, just over $400 in all. Good, she thought. This was enough to get her moving. The eastbound turning lane off Route 123 into CIA headquarters was infamous. Here, on January 25, 1993, a Pakistani national in the United States on forged papers dumped 10 rounds from his AK-47 into cars waiting to turn into the agency, killing two CIA employees and injuring three more. Suzanne Brewer wasn't thinking about the turn lane's history now, even though she sat in the middle of it in her Infiniti sedan, right on top of where the attack took place. She knew all about the murders, for sure, although she'd been in high school when it happened. As a CIA officer, she had spent much of her career protecting the agency from threats and had exhaustively studied the 1993 attack, all the way up to the 1997 arrest in Pakistan of Mir Qasi and his 2002 lethal injection for his act. Right now, Brewer had other, more contemporary events on her mind. With two attacks on personnel in the last 8 hours, the former facility threat expert wanted answers, but that wasn't her job anymore. Now she was Hanley's working dog, an indentured servant to the deputy director of operations in charge of managing Sub Rosa off-book assets. She made the turn into HQ at 5 a.m., anxious to have a couple of hours in the office before attending the crisis center meeting at 7 about Turnhill and Great Falls. She'd just begun heading up the drive when her phone rang, and she answered it over the car speakers.
Brewer.
It's Matt. How soon can you be in my office?
Parking now, sir. 10 to 15.
10 would be better.
Hanley hung up, and Brewer groaned aloud in her car. If he was already here in his office, wanting to speak with her in person even before the 7 a.m. meeting, then it was a safe bet he was scheming something, something she would likely be tasked with carrying out. Suzanne Brewer walked down the hall to Matt Hanley's office 13 minutes later. Heavy throngs of men and women passed by, the noise level higher than usual here on the 7th floor, and there was a sense of urgency to the scene. This had nothing to do with Turnhill or Great Falls, Brewer knew. Instead, everyone up here was busy because of what Brewer saw as a stupid and pointless conference they would all be attending in Scotland in a few days. Everyone on the floor, virtually all of the executives along with dozens of mid- and upper-level subordinates, would fly to the UK on Saturday. They'd spend a day at the US Embassy in London, prepping with members of the CIA station there, and then they would fly or take trains north to the Scottish Highlands for the annual 3-day Five Eyes Conference, to be held in a completely restored and massive 15th-century castle overlooking Loch Ness. The intelligence agencies of the five English-speaking nations of the world, the United States, Canada, the United Kingdom, Australia, and New Zealand, were known collectively as the Five Eyes. They shared all manner of intel product between one another, and they worked together whenever they could. The Five Eyes conducted a regular cycle of conferences, each year in one of the five nations. The previous year had been in Wellington, New Zealand. Next year, it would be in Toronto. But the United Kingdom had host duties for this year's gathering. Senior operational, analytical, and executive staff from the intelligence agencies of all five participating nations would get together, some 400 spies, spy masters, and IC experts in all, and they would attend briefing after briefing about the ongoing and emerging threats facing the Five Eyes' interests. Brewer wasn't going to Five Eyes this year, and she saw it as perhaps the only perk of working on Poison Apple. Sub Rosa initiatives weren't discussed with the partner nations, so she saw no reason to go and rub shoulders with colleagues from other services to whom she wouldn't be able to say much of anything. Brewer passed by Jill, Hanley's executive assistant, with a nod, and entered through the open door of his office. While the rest of the floor seemed to be almost frantically preparing for the mass exodus, Matt Hanley appeared relaxed, looking over papers with a glass bottle of apple juice next to him. She sat down while Hanley finished reading the page in his hand. She knew Matt himself had become somewhat legendary in his ability to get out of attending the conference in years past, usually due to critical deployments, but now he was the new top dog of CIA ops and would be one of the senior attendees at the event in Edinburgh.
"You've had a night,"
he said as he looked her over.
"More like a nightmare."
"Any sleep?"
Brewer knew he wouldn't take pity on her and cut her any slack if she told him the truth, that she hadn't even put her head down on a pillow, so she responded with,
"I'm fine, Matt."
"I want to start working on the potential moles today."
Brewer nodded thoughtfully.
"And by working on them, you mean what exactly?"
"Watching them, leaning on them."
"I can assemble a surveillance team from operational and technical staff, but as far as leaning on them..."
Hanley interrupted.
"We put a poison apple asset on them, outfitted with rules of engagement that will unease the potential traitors, cause them to make mistakes, reveal themselves, tickle the wires just to see what happens."
Brewer said,
"Violator is in play in the UK right now. Anthem wasn't even operational before she snuck out of the safe house during a massacre. So am I to assume you are talking about Romantic?"
"That's right. He's perfect for this job. Where is he?"
"He's in the DC area. I have him in training. Won't be difficult to get him here."
"I want him heading this way within the hour."
"Sir, I don't know about him coming into the office."
Hanley said,
"Of course not. You'll meet him somewhere off-site. Tell him what we need from him."
Brewer hesitated.
"Are you sure about this, Matt? Sure about sending an off-book asset, especially one like Romantic, to intimidate high-ranking agency colleagues?"
"The only thing I'm sure of is that my people are dying, and nobody is doing shit to stop it. That changes now."
Hanley added,
"Romantic will be happy for the work, especially because it involves being an asshole to agency suits."
"The problem will be keeping him on a leash."
She then asked,
"Who are the suspects?"
Matt Hanley said,
"Assuming the event last night in the Great Falls was part of the same compromise, that removes the Transportation Division-only suspects. Those who knew about Great Falls and all four of the aircraft movements that were compromised make for a very small subset."
"How small?"
"Besides you and me, four people. Two in operations and two in support."
When he said nothing more, Brewer pressed,
"I'll need the names, Matt, won't I?"
Her sarcasm was ignored by her deputy director. Instead, he just said,
"Marty Wheeler, support."
Brewer had known Wheeler for the past 3 years. Moreover, she knew he and Hanley were friends. He'd shown up at the safe house earlier in the morning. She wrote his name down, but said nothing.
"Got it.
Maria Palumbo, ops."
Brewer knew Palumbo well.
She was new at the HQ here in McLean, having spent virtually all of her career in embassies around the Middle East, Asia, and Europe, but Brewer had worked at many of the same facilities. Palumbo had been in harm's way more times than Brewer, and Brewer couldn't imagine her betraying her own organization. Hanley said, "Number three is Alf Carlson, also in operations." Brewer only knew the handsome first-generation Swede socially. They'd never worked together at all. She said, "He had knowledge of all the events?"
"Yes, like the others."
She wrote down the name. Brewer asked, "Who is number four?"
"Lucas Renfro."
Brewer's mouth opened in disbelief.
"The deputy director of support? That's ludicrous. He's a department head, 35 years in the U.S. intelligence community."
Hanley said,
"We have to investigate all leads."
"Investigate?"
She said the word with an air of dubiousness.
"Renfro doesn't like me. He wanted to be DDO, is pissed I got it. Plus, he is by the book to a fault. I am not. That gives him motive. He knows I have sub rosa activities, and he wants to put a stop to them."
"By passing secrets to the Chinese and the Russians and whoever else?" "I don't believe that for a minute. Sure, he wanted the promotion you got, I don't doubt that, but there is no way he would turn traitor just to see you fail."
Hanley said,
"Nothing else makes sense, Suzanne."
"With respect, sir, anything else makes more sense."
The big man sighed.
"I know you're doing this under duress."
She thought he was about to throw her some sort of lifeline, but instead he said,
"Just do it anyway."
"Right." She looked at her notes with the names.
"I guess I need to tell Romantic where to start."
To this, Hanley said,
"I'll tell you where to start. He can check them all out, but I want him leaning on Lucas Renfro hard."
Brewer looked up to her boss.
"This is beginning to sound so personal."
Hanley shook his head.
"He's an asshole. Never heard it said that assholes can't also be traitors. In fact, I'd say there's likely a positive correlation."
Brewer stood and headed back to her office. Chapter 10. 2 years earlier. Wan Jang Mi sat at a computer monitor in a windowless room, but through the walls she could hear the whipping snowstorm. Winters in this part of Russia could be harsh, more brutal than anything she'd ever seen in her native North Korea. Every day she walked from her apartment in the dreary town of Shikini, boarded a special bus, and then sat quietly for the 15-minute ride to Shikini 2, the Russian Defense Force military base where she worked. She'd been here for 4 months already. She appreciated the good facilities and her intelligent colleagues, but she didn't really know why she was in the middle of a snow-covered forest studying viruses with Russians. She wanted to be an operative, not some glorified foreign exchange student. A knock at the door of her tiny room surprised her. She usually was left alone here and did most of her talking with her Russian colleagues in the lab or conference room.
"Enter,"
she said in her rapidly improving Russian. A man in his 30s whom Juan had never seen came in. She stood and shook his hand, giving off a hint of discomfort while doing so.
"My name is Alexei Filatov," he said.
"Dr. Wan Jang Mi."
Behind him, the colonel who managed the entire facility leaned into the doorway.
"Doctor," he said, "this man is with the government. He would like to speak with you about your work. I thought you could take a few minutes."
"Certainly," she said, confused about what exact part of the Russian government the stranger in the suit worked for, and just what he wanted to know.
The director reached in and took the door latch, then closed Juan and the man in the tiny dark room, which only increased Juan's misgivings. She suffered from severe social anxiety, and even shaking hands was a difficult task that she'd had to master to leave her nation and head to foreign lands, all of which were full of men and women who always seemed to want to touch one another. When they touched her or even moved close to her, she found it sickening. But she weathered the close contact with this man and asked, How can I help you?
I have been hearing good things about your research here. I am not a doctor, so you will have to keep things simple for me. But I would appreciate an explanation of what you are doing.
I have a specific specialty, Mr. Filatov. I am willing to talk about this, as my government has told me to collaborate in any way I can.
And what is your specialty, Jiang Mi?
The woman bristled.
Jiang Mi is my given name. Wan is my surname. I would prefer you simply call me Doctor, Mr. Filatov.
With apologies, Doctor.
The two sat in the only two chairs in the room. She said,
I am an expert on Category A organisms. Do you know what those are?
Filatov nodded.
Go on.
Wan detected a certain perfunctory nature to the man's tone.
Is this something that interests you personally, professionally, or perhaps you are a government functionary merely ordered here to find information?
Filatov did not deny his motivations.
Very much the latter, Doctor. I have been assigned to meet with several biological warfare experts around the nation. No disrespect, but frankly, it is boring work. My country has focused its energies on chemical weapons for more than 30 years. The state of our biological research, as you are probably well aware, is in shambles.
Wan would not admit it, but the facilities here were far superior to anything she'd ever seen in North Korea. Filatov added,
But then I heard about you. I am hoping you will have some technology, some insight, some knowledge that goes beyond what I've been hearing from my own countrymen for the past several weeks. North Korea, from what I've been told, has been pursuing bioweapons aggressively.
Wan said, We have. All different types and strains. My specialty, however, is weaponized plague.
The Russian reached into his jacket.
May I smoke?
It's your country.
He lit a cigarette. He still didn't seem terribly interested in this encounter, and Wan was already looking forward to getting back to work, hoping he wouldn't shake her hand again on the way out. Filatov said,
I know next to nothing about plague, I'm afraid.
Wan began a short primer.
In the history of mankind, plague has been the second largest killer of all epidemic diseases, behind only smallpox. The Black Death of the 14th century that killed between 75 and 200 million people in 4 years was bubonic plague, which targets the lymph nodes. Pneumonic plague, in contrast, targets the lungs. The bacteria that causes plague, Yersinia pestis, is relatively easy to acquire around the world. It is something an expert can grow in a laboratory and is easily disseminated by aerosol delivery or other means. Further, there is a very high lethality rate when using pneumonic plague as opposed to the more easily treated bubonic plague and secondary spread, infected hosts infecting others before they die, is not only possible, it's all but assured.
Filatov took another drag on his cigarette.
It's a weapon.
A magnificent weapon, when carefully produced, maintained, and distributed by an expert. As opposed to toxins, most biological weapons, plague included, consist of living organisms, and this means they can reproduce once dispersed.
Wan was in her element now. Her social anxiety and general insecurity were forgotten because she was speaking about the only subject she had really focused on since her early 20s. Filatov said,
What are the effects?
Would you like me to show you?
He thought she was kidding. When her deadpan expression revealed she was not, he asked,
What do you mean?
She motioned to her computer.
I am in possession of a video of a test we ran 4 years ago in my country. Would you like to see it?
A test on what?
On human beings.
The Russian's eyes went wide.
Very much so.
She queued up a file on her screen.
This video has never been shown outside Pyongyang. It has never been shown outside my research laboratory, to the best of my knowledge.
Filatov said,
I am honored.
She looked back to him.
You might find it disturbing.
Now the Russian smiled and took another drag.
I sincerely hope I do.
She hit play on the device, and the screen displayed a group of men and women in white prison uniforms, standing in orderly rows in the center of a concrete prison yard. Walls and barbed wire were evident behind them, and armed guards ringed the group.
Who are the test subjects? Filatov asked.
She hit pause. Political prisoners in the DPRK. We gave them westernized rations for 6 weeks to build their strength to approximate the enemy population. We also gave them more access to sunlight, more sleep, more water, more medicine. The majority of these subjects were quite healthy when the test began, although, frankly, they were not nearly so healthy as the average Westerner. So I suspect the test results ultimately were skewed in the direction of slight exaggeration of outcome.
How many prisoners were used?
We used 100 for the primary test, which I thought to be excessive, but I was overruled. The demonstration could have been made just as easily, and the results nearly as statistically significant, with 20 men and women.
Filatov said,
100 is a good even number. Please continue.
The screen showed the prisoners, still in the prison yard, in two lines walking through a small concrete building, not much larger than a potting shed.
Juan said, Here they are being administered the agent I personally designed. My strain of bacteria has been altered to allow increased pathogenicity, meaning a stronger effect from the spores, and a shorter incubation period, meaning less time before the effects become fatal. Furthermore, my strain allows more time before symptoms present, an average of 4 to 6.5 days. This will give the hosts time to infect others with secondary pneumonic plague before their own sickness even registers.
That is impressive, Doctor.
The video showed the inside of the small building now. Nozzles jutted from the walls and ceiling. She said,
It is sprayed in aerosol form, but it is odorless and completely invisible. The sound of the expulsion of the agent would have been evident to the prisoners, but there was no way they would have been able to discern what was happening to them.
She added,
After they were exposed, they retired to their cells. The guards were given daily courses of antibiotics, so they would not have to wear protective gear and skew the test results by making it obvious the population had been infected. If antibiotics are not administered in the first 8 hours and continued through a course of a week or more, the patient has little chance of survival.
With nonchalance, she added,
This population was administered no antibiotics whatsoever.
A new camera angle, again, of the concrete yard, and again, all the prisoners were lined up in rows.
Juan said, Here they are at the end of day one. No symptoms evident. Even after 24 hours. The same at the end of day two. This is to be expected with normal strains of pneumonic plague.
The video image changed to show a woman in a prison uniform, obviously in an infirmary or clinic there at the labor camp, having her blood pressure taken by someone in a full hazmat suit. She was coughing into a paper towel.
On day three, hour 55 in the trial, a single subject showed symptoms. This is a 61-year-old woman who had already spent 10 years in the labor camps.
Juan glanced to Filatov.
Chronically malnourished, unhealthy, notwithstanding the weeks we attempted to strengthen her and bolster her immune system, I assessed her health as that of the average 85-year-old Westerner.
She played the video a few seconds more, and there were more men and women in the clinic now being evaluated. Some lay on gurneys, others remained standing.
On day four, there were 7 showing symptoms. The 61-year-old woman was unable to get off the stretcher without help. The others had coughs, 2 presented with fever. Again, these were the older and the less fit.
Filatov watched more film, the sick lined up in a darkened hallway, guards walking among them.
On day five, 16 prisoners had fallen ill. Our first subject was wholly incapacitated at this point.
The monitor displayed the woman on the hard floor mat, convulsing and vomiting.
We quickly took the 15 who showed symptoms but were still ambulatory and put them here, in a second prison yard. A similar space to the first was shown, and a large group of men and women stood at attention in the middle of the concrete floor.
This location is sequestered 500 meters from the first. Our aim here was to check the efficacy of secondary pneumonic plague. As in the primary trial, 100 subjects were exposed.
The 15 men and women showing symptoms from the primary trial entered the yard. The prisoners were dismissed from their rows, and soon they were all intermingling. Juan said,
It is not an airborne disease. For someone to become a secondary patient, they generally must be within 2 meters of a host subject who is showing symptoms. Coughing, for example. Still, the West is a generally crowded place. Plague can be an insidious beast.
I have no doubt, Doctor.
On day 6, 26 patients in the primary trial showed symptoms. On day 7, that number had grown to 71. The woman who presented first died on this day, along with another subject.
The grainy video continued, showing the dead woman and rows of prostrate sick lying in the open yard. Filatov leaned towards the screen, entranced by the power of the microscopic bacteria.
Day 8, Juan said. By now, 88 showed coughing, fever, vomiting. There was morbidity in some extremities, the onset of gangrene. It was really quite impressive.
The camera in the prison infirmary showed blackened fingers and toes on many of the patients.
By day 9, all 100 of the primary subjects had developed symptoms of plague. 9 had died. By day 10, the number of deaths had risen to 51.
The Russian leaned back in his chair now.
Ultimately, of the 100 primary subjects, how many died?
All of them died, Mr. Filatov. The longest lived 15 days, which was something of a miracle, but he was 21 and very healthy before he was infected.
And of the 100 secondary subjects, what was their mortality rate?
63 dead, so 63%. My prediction had been between 50 and 75%, so I was quite satisfied with my analysis.
163 out of 200.
Yes, but those secondary subjects would have, if they were in an uncontrolled population, caused tertiary infections in others.
Juan smiled.
It is hard to predict what the mortality rate would be in that population, but it is also difficult to overestimate the danger of plague when released.
Filatov said,
I will deal with you. I am an intelligence officer. I am no scientist. But my organization would like to know one thing. Do you have everything you need to weaponize this on a larger scale?
She nodded. This filled her with excitement, although she still took this conversation as theoretical, because Filatov had not mentioned any specifics.
Is there any question that your weapon will work?
There is one gap in my knowledge on the subject, which prevents me from answering that question with specificity.
Filatov sat up straighter, obviously surprised to hear this from the woman who seemed so completely self-assured about her expertise.
And what would that be?
The DPRK knows very little about existing biodefenses set up by the West. Do Western nations have security measures intact to respond to an attack? Are hospitals in major cities prepared? Are enough oral and IV drugs staged to combat a mass casualty event? Are there protocols to identify the origin of a devastating plague outbreak? I simply do not have as much of this information as I require.
And where could you go to obtain this information?
Juan shrugged.
Two places that I know of, Stockholm and Atlanta. Stockholm is the location of the European Center for Disease Prevention and Control, and Atlanta, Georgia, in the United States, is the location of the CDC. America's Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Filatov took some notes.
If we could help you obtain a position at either of these locations, would you be able to fill in these knowledge gaps you speak of?
Juan replied with a little confusion.
I don't work for Russia. I work for...
Filatov waved a hand.
Our two nations have shared interests in the knowledge you could obtain. We could speak with officials in your country and work on this together.
She thought it over.
I do not want to go to America.
Juan smiled now, and she did not smile often.
But I will go to Sweden if you can arrange it. both with the center there and with my leadership back home.
Within months, Juan left Russia and moved to Stockholm, taking a job as a researcher at the European Center for Disease Prevention and Control. The Russians secured the job for her, secured her cover identity, secured the money she needed to set herself up in the European capital. The North Koreans, for their part, allowed Juan Jang-mi to go. The Russians and the North Koreans both wanted to know everything about biosecurity in the West, and Juan had the same goal as her masters. She needed to understand the protective measures in place so that she and her plague could find a way around them. 2 years to the month after wading ashore on a moonlit beach in Japan, she sat down at the desk in her new office in Stockholm. Chapter 11. Present day. The abandoned hospital just south of the hamlet of Rossby had originally been built in the 1890s and served as a mental asylum until World War II, when it was employed as a crash and burns unit for the RAF. After the war, it reverted to its original role, run by the National Health Service, serving until the 1990s, when it was shut down for good. Now the wards, halls, offices, laboratories, treatment rooms, and nurses' quarters were abandoned, suffering mightily the decay of time. Vines snaked through windows and mold grew along the tile flooring. Some furniture and fixtures remained, but everything else was rotting or rusted, mildewed or broken. Graffiti adorned the walls, mice and batshit were piled everywhere, and green newts clung to the walls. It was an empty, hollow shell, with dusty shafts of light beaming left and right through broken windows along the long corridors and high-ceilinged rooms. Anthony Kent stood in one of these shafts in the large and hazily lit dining hall, itself in the center of the massive former sanitarium. A rotting wooden stage loomed at the far end of the hall, and in front of that, three men stood around in light jackets with weapons slung over their shoulders. In the center of the group was a man seated on a chair with a black bag over his head. Kent knew absolutely nothing about the prisoner, other than the fact that he was a big prize that someone had paid a lot of money to recover, and thus many poor sods had died in the process. The Englishman looked at his watch. He was waiting for a call, and he prayed it would come soon, so he could be done with this wretched day. Anthony Kent was a highwayman for the Nottingham Syndicate, a family-run criminal firm that specialized in extortion, shipping and transportation theft, and prostitution all across the East Midlands. The majority of his work involved hijacking trucks, usually in brazen but straightforward armed robberies, stealing everything from beer and liquor to medical supplies to be resold on the black market. In addition to this, he also served as one of Nottingham Syndicate's chief enforcers, abducting enemies of the group and beating them back into line. And this was how he knew about the abandoned hospital. This building in which he now stood had been home to some of his most brutal actions as a mob enforcer. While not officially a safe house of the group, Kent knew he'd be killed by his boss for taking this prisoner to some actual safe house and connecting the Nottingham Syndicate with the attack on MI6. This ruined building had served for years as something of a torture chamber. Certain that he and the survivors of tonight's attack would be safe here, he'd made the decision to drive across the middle of the island nation to be back on his own turf, where he knew the lay of the land. All six of the other survivors of the airport shootout were members of different gangs across England, and like Kent, sent on this job by their employers, who had been hired to provide crew members for the operation. Kent had heard a rumor that this entire affair had been set up by a shadow man in London, and his boss had been paid £250,000. Kent himself would be paid £75,000 for all this, but at the moment he felt he'd drastically undercharged for his services. The one good thing that had happened since they opened fire at the airport was the arrival of more help. When Kent called his boss, the man who'd sent him on this mad endeavor, and told him they'd lost six of their number and he was heading to this abandoned hospital to lay up, his employer told him he would have reinforcements waiting for him. And, true to his word, when Kent and his men arrived, they found six armed men, many of whom Kent had worked with in the past. He'd wasted no time in positioning the new arrivals around the building for security, and this allowed him to breathe his first sigh of relief in hours. Still, he knew he was in over his head. He wasn't a leader, he wasn't a soldier. He'd killed multiple times, but had never been involved in anything remotely as large-scale as what had happened in Turnhill this morning. His phone rang and he snatched it out of his pocket. It was the inbound helicopter telling them they would arrive in 20 minutes. He hung up and notified his men outside to make one last concerted scan of the area to ensure that all was clear. Kent walked over to the prisoner now, but addressed the men guarding him.
"Chopper's 20 minutes out. Look alive, lads."
Dirk Visser's head turned to the voice. Through the bag and in accented English, the banker said,
"You're in charge here?"
The Englishman said,
"I guess I am, yeah."
Visser said,
"Look, friend, thank you for rescuing me. Now I just want to go back home. Why am I still tied? Why am I blindfolded? I have nothing to do with..."
Kent snapped back.
"I'm not your fucking friend, mate. Don't talk to me, don't talk to anyone at all. Just sit your ass there and wait. You'll be getting a ride out of here soon enough."
"A ride? A ride to where?"
"Don't know, but I'd hazard a guess you're gonna get a talking to here before they take you away."
He looked around the room. God knows this bloody place has seen its share of interrogations. Court moved across the property carefully, passing a derelict chapel and scooting along behind a low brick wall, half broken by time and the elements. He crawled through the tall grass, remaining low enough to avoid detection, and made it to within 100 feet of the eastern wall of the Target building. Here, there was one more building between himself and the old hospital. He decided to look in to see if he could move through the building next to him instead of around it, fighting his way past brambles and some broken old hospital beds smothered in vines. He arrived at a window and looked in. A sign on a door inside said, "Viewing Room." He wasn't sure what he was supposed to view on the other side, but whatever it was, he figured it was probably not much to look at, considering the poor condition of the structure. He stepped through the window, carefully measured his footsteps around broken glass, and made his way into the room. He passed through the door of the viewing room and found the space behind it completely empty, other than papers and plaster on the floor. In front of him, however, he saw 3 doors, each with a faded sign attached. Female, post-mortem, and male. He was standing in the middle of an abandoned mortuary. He entered through the middle door and found himself in post-mortem. There were broken lab tables and another stretcher, and to the right was a doorway to a flight of stairs that went down into darkness. Court took the stairs, sensing there was some sort of underground access to the hospital itself. He pulled the headlamp out of his pack and flipped it on the red light setting, because red light does not cause pupils to shrink like white light does, so he could retain some of his night vision. Before him, he saw a tunnel that did, indeed, lead off in the direction of the large building at the center of this property. The tunnel was rank with mold and ankle-deep in water and trash, but with the dim red light from his headlamp leading the way, Court moved out, slowly, so as to make as little noise as possible. He didn't think there were enough people on this property for them to post a guard down here, but he knew he couldn't be sure. The passage had been built wide enough for a gurney to be pushed along. Obviously, it was designed to move bodies from the hospital to the morgue. Black and green lizards shot along the walls and ceiling while Court negotiated the decades of trash along the floor. Halfway up the tunnel, he could see that it ended at a pile of garbage in front of a metal door. Court continued to within 20 feet, covered his headlamp with his hand, and used the faint light that shone through his fingers to make his way over the pile. He turned the light off now, opened the door enough to squeeze his body through, and after this, he stood silently for a full minute, listening for any sounds. Eventually, he put his earplugs back in and turned them on. Court flipped on his headlamp, back on its red light setting. He stood in a dusty basement, so he made his way to the stairwell at the end. Court climbed, exceedingly careful with every footfall. At the top, he realized he was in a former medical ward of the hospital. Porcelain sinks lined the wall, metal tables and trays and shelving units lay twisted and turned. The broken window in the room looked out to a courtyard of high weeds, and a small road beyond that snaked through several other buildings in the complex. There was what looked like an old army barracks, a water tower, and a massive parking garage. He also saw the two cars he'd noticed from the air, parked there behind the building, and was surprised when he recognized the models. One was a Dodge Charger. It was matte gray and appeared to be at least 10 years old. The other was a 25-year-old black Mercedes-Benz SL500 sedan. Assuming the Mercedes to be the V8 model, and certain the Charger was a V8 Hemi, Court knew he was looking at two muscle cars, something of a rarity in Britain, and he worried this meant the men from Turnhill had received reinforcements. He looked out into a corridor illuminated by shafts of light through the windows. Here he turned on his hearing enhancement again, and he immediately recoiled at the sound. A helicopter was approaching. It changed pitch, and this told him it was in the process of landing. He worried the prisoner would be spirited out of the area before he could make a play for him, and he also realized the opportunity that the noise of the landing helo gave him. He knew from the windows that he was in the east wing of the building, so he moved into the corridor, turned to his left, and began hurrying as fast as possible, staying out of the dusty sunlight as he went. Six men climbed out of the Airbus H-145 helicopter from London and began walking quickly towards the west wing entrance of the hospital. Their eyes scanned the entire property as they moved, and the man in the center of the group did not seem pleased at all about the surroundings. Roger Fox was 39 years old, with reddish-brown hair styled neatly and a trim goatee. He told people he'd been educated at Princeton in the United States, and he wore a charcoal suit made by Seville Rose Henry Poole, along with a Rolex Cosmograph Daytona. Four men in his security component carried submachine guns under their light jackets, but they did their best to hide the weaponry as they advanced on the building, unsure about this location and its proximity to wandering eyes. The fifth man in the group was John Hines, Fox's personal bodyguard. As always, Hines walked just behind him, a half step back. At 6'9" tall, he wore 260 pounds of sinewy muscle like an athlete. Like a weapon. Hines was English, 41 years old, and a former boxer. He carried an FN pistol on his hip under his jacket, and he knew how to use it, but all seven of the men he'd killed in his life to date, he'd done with his bare hands, and he'd never once drawn his gun in a fight, simply because he'd never seen the need. Anthony Kent stood in the doorway of the West Wing. He waved the group over to him. As the group converged, the Englishman looked around, trying to identify the man he'd spoken with on the phone, although he'd had no idea what he looked like. It was hard to take his eyes off the massive frame of muscle in a suit looming just behind the smaller man in the goatee, but when the smaller man extended a hand, Kent looked to him and extended his own.
"Mr. Fox?"
Fox shook Kent's hand without smiling. In a British accent, he said,
"Yes. What the hell is this place?"
"It's safe," Kent said.
"Been coming here for years for a wee bit of quiet."
Fox stepped with Kent into the building. His men bracketed them front to back.
"The prisoner?"
Kent said.
"We have him inside. Haven't told him anything."
"Has he offered anything?"
"No, he's scared."
"Good," Fox said,
and he pushed past the smaller Englishman. His men did the same, and Kent followed.
"Have to say it, sir, I was worried we'd been working for the fucking Russians. Nice to see that a proper Englishman is in charge. Don't much care for the bloody Russians who've taken over London with their flash and their mess."
Fox made no reply. Kent went ahead, directing them through the West Wing into the large room with the stage. The entourage walked up to the three in the center of the room standing over the hooded prisoner. Fox did not acknowledge the three, only reached over and yanked the bag off Dirk Visser's head. The man looked up at him, sweat dripping from his face.
"It's him," Fox said, then added, "Kent, take your men out into the corridor. I'd quite like to speak with my new friend here alone."
The four Englishmen did as ordered. This was the man paying their wages, after all. When the British were gone, Fox looked down at Visser.
"I'm from London, and you might not yet know why I am here.
I will tell you what I am not here to do. I am not here to fuck about. We know CIA picked you up in Luxembourg, which means they know you are the banker tied to a particular account at your bank that is of interest to us.
Yes, that's right, Visser said helpfully. The British or the Americans have a mole in my bank. It's the only thing that makes sense. They identified the account and recognized I was the one maintaining it, converting amounts to Bitcoin and then transferring them to the U.S.
What have you told the CIA in the time you've been their captive?
Nothing. I haven't said a word. And I won't say anything. Not to the Americans, the British. I'm just a banker. I've done nothing wrong.
Fox knelt down slowly, all the way to Visser's face.
I told you I wasn't here to fuck about. I know there's more. I know you have been doing some looking into the owners of the shell company that made recent deposits into the account you manage.
The banker cocked his head, a genuine show of surprise.
What do you mean? I know nothing about the depositor. I don't know if it's a shell or not, nor how the shell is run. But I know how it works. Normally, there is no true principal as a signatory to the Articles of Incorporation. It's all done by nominating agents, lawyers working for lawyers, shells within shells. Even if I wanted information about the company, I wouldn't be able to get it.
Visser smiled a little.
That's how everyone stays safe.
Yeah, and yet here you are, Fox said. Not too bloody safe, are you, mate?
Yes, but I haven't told anyone.
I'm going to say a name, Fox interrupted. When I say it, I want you to tell me where you heard it.
A half nod from the seated man.
Fyodor Zakharov.
Visser shook his head slowly.
I don't think I have ever heard that name. Should I know him?
The man in the goatee stood back up now and looked to the huge man standing with him. Still to Visser, he said,
Two nights ago, the CIA picks you up. Then last night, the CIA looks into a 14-year-old file of this man, a man known to us. He is
somehow involved with the account I manage, or the company that deposited into the account?
Fox looked up at Hines.
John, will you remind Visser here that I am the one asking the questions?
The big man instantly fired an open hand out. The whack of palm against face echoed through the cavernous main hall. Stunned and in pain, Visser looked back up to the man looming over him with terror in his eyes, as if he just now realized the danger he was in.
Fox said, You told them about Zakharov. How did you know? Who else did you tell?
I swear to you, I don't even know that name. Perhaps there is a mole in your organization. Perhaps they found out some other way.
No, Visser. No other way. You talked.
Hines's hand whipped out again, slapping the man even harder, and this time the banker screamed. Chapter 12. Court heard a distant scream echoing through the massive hospital. He'd been moving through a nurse's break room, carefully bypassing a man patrolling up the hallway with a flashlight. He stopped in his tracks, and when the next scream came, he was able to identify the sound as coming from up the hall to the west. He moved to the doorway and lay down, waited until he heard the footsteps of the patrolling sentry begin climbing a staircase nearby, then scooted on the floor until his head was outside in the hall, and he was facing in the direction from where the screams came. 100 feet up the hall, he saw a group of four men standing in a wide shaft of window light in front of double doors opposite from the main entrance to the hospital. He tapped his audio-enhancing earplugs and immediately began picking up the whispered conversation of the men as it echoed off the tile and plaster in the long, empty space. Court had missed the beginning of the conversation, but he quickly got the impression that the helicopter he'd heard land had dropped off a group, and they were now with the prisoner through the door that was behind the four men in sight. Another scream from the room behind them told Court that the newcomers were really working this guy over. So Court recognized now, this was not a simple rescue of a man held by the CIA. These people wanted something from this banker, just as much as the agency and MI6 did.
Sucks for him,
Court tuned into the conversation, desperate to pick up more intel about what was going on. A man with a thick British accent said,
"Look, Ken, it's not like we don't trust you, it's that we don't even know you. You might have been pegged as the man to run the crew if Martin and Mickey went around, but none of us know this Fox bloke either. I don't trust him."
The man being addressed said,
"Same as you lot. I was sent by my boss to do this job. And now he's fucking furious at whoever sent this shite up. I either get this sorted, or I end up buried in a bleeding ditch somewhere. I don't know Fox, just met him when he climbed off the alley. I do what I'm told, and I was told to run things if the first two men went down. Hopefully these sharp-dressed fucks will take that Dutch geezer in there and we'll be done with this. You can go back to Southampton, Bristol, London, wherever, spend your money, and try to forget this ever happened."
Court lifted his phone, activated the camera, and zoomed it in all the way, centering on the group of men. He stabilized his arm against the doorframe and took 24 pictures in just a few seconds, using a light-enhancing mode. He hoped Brewer would use facial recognition analysis to identify some or all of the men, but what he really needed now was to find a way to get to the prisoner.
"No," Court thought. "I can't extract the banker until I know more about my opposition."
He cursed Brewer in silence, although he knew this wasn't her fault. John Hines smacked Dirk Visser across the face for a third time, and this time the Dutchman fell to the floor. The big man grabbed him by the throat and slammed him back down on the chair without a word or a sound. Hines enjoyed beating people up. As a kid, he'd been the biggest and strongest, but his overbearing mother called him a clumsy oaf and tried to put him in ballet. He made it 5 minutes in his first class till the stares and snickers got to him. He was 12 and 6'1". He left and went straight to the boxing gym next door. He had no money on him, and his mum wasn't returning to pick him up for an hour, but when the trainers set eyes on the massive child, they smiled at one another and put him in the ring for a free session. He told himself that if he could move like the American champ Mike Tyson, then his mum wouldn't pick on him, and if he could fight like Mike Tyson, then no one would pick on him. He was a star at the gym from day one. His mum relented and paid for his lessons, and he became a fixture there, a pet project for the trainers. Throughout his teen years, he grew even bigger and continued with his boxing. He also studied judo and karate, but when he was 18, he joined the army, serving as a light machine gunner in the Royal Anglian Regiment. He boxed in the infantry, of course, but he fought dirty, always. After 3 years, he left to try his hand as a prize fighter in the robust boxing system in the UK. His career never took off, as he remained hampered by his inability to follow the rules of the sport. There was no one who could go toe-to-toe for long with the quick and skilled giant of a man. But Hines was constantly having points deducted for rabbit punches, low blows, stepping on his opponent's feet, and hitting them after the bell. He either won his matches quickly with knockouts, or lost them on point deductions, or outright disqualification. Eventually, his untamed aggression became too much, even in a sport where men were scored on their ability to hit one another in the face. Since he failed as a boxer, he began working for a loan shark in Portsmouth. Here, there were no rules about low blows or rabbit punches, but even in this work, he managed to step out of bounds. He accidentally beat a man to death and then was promptly arrested and convicted. He was sent to HM Prison Wakefield, the toughest correctional facility in the nation. The complex was known as the Monster Mansion for all of the high-profile lowlifes incarcerated there. Hines was sentenced to 6 years behind the fence, and with only 5 months remaining in his sentence, he ran afoul of a pair of young, muscular Russian inmates over a prime seat in the TV room. The 6'9 Hines had taken a chair in the front of the room to watch a heavyweight fight, and the two brothers complained that they couldn't see the screen. Hines ignored them for the entire 2-hour run of the program, then quietly stood and walked into the bathroom. The brothers followed, with a young Russian entering behind. Everyone in the prison knew Artyom Primakov, and they knew that he was a member of the Vori, a made man in the Russian mafia. He'd been arrested for possession of forged documents and sentenced to 4 years, and was set to be deported back to Russia upon his release. When Hines saw the dangerous Primakov, he said,
"You've got fuck all to do with this, mate. I know who you are, but I don't give a toss. I will beat you down just the same."
Primakov just smiled, then motioned to the two young toughs to get to work on the big blonde Englishman. Hines then proceeded to dismantle both of the hard men, barely breaking a sweat as he cracked orbital bones, jaws, and ribs and left them on the floor covered in blood. Then John Hines looked up at Primakov, his red swollen knuckles still tightened into fists. Primakov began to clap.
"Marvelous! Well done! But what now, friend? The 5 remaining months of your sentence just turned into another 10 years for your actions of the last 90 seconds.
Hines moved forward, raising his fists.
"Unless," Primakov continued, backpedaling while he talked, "unless I get you out of it, I could have one of my other men take the blame for this."
Hines slowed. His rage and adrenaline were in control, but his brain had at least heard what the Russian gangsters said.
"Why the fuck would you do that?"
2 reasons. 1, the obvious. So you don't break my neck. And 2, you were attacked. You were only defending yourself. But the guards won't see that. The British legal system will condemn you. I don't think that is fair. Do you?
The truth was that Primakov realized he couldn't let an asset like John Hines get away, so he ordered one of his men, a lifer in prison for a homicide in London, to confess administering the beatdown. John Hines was released from prison 5 months later. Primakov was still on the inside, but he made contact with some associates in his organization, the London Brigade of the Russian multinational criminal organization known as the Solentsevskaya Bratva. Soon, the big former boxer was employed as a security officer for senior members. Primakov was sent back to Russia, but he made his way back into the UK on a new, improved set of forged papers, claiming to be Roger Fox, a subject of the United Kingdom. Unlike his last visit to the UK, when he posed as a Russian immigrant, now his English was flawless and spoken in the common multicultural London dialect. And John Hines became his bodyguard, a permanent fixture at his side. Visser's nose snapped with a crack during Hines's next hit. This time the big Brit used a closed fist, and although it wasn't a very hard punch, it was perfectly placed and an exceedingly efficient application of force. The banker's head went down, and he continued mumbling something about his innocence in all this, but Fox was not listening. Instead, he looked to Hines.
"Put him in the helicopter. Mars can decide what to do with him."
"Yes, sir,"
Hines replied, and then he hoisted the man up and onto his shoulder, carrying him like a sack of flour. Court remained on the filthy floor, his eyes just past the doorframe into the hallway, so he could observe the men he'd been listening to. He remained confident they wouldn't be able to see him in the darkness some 100 feet away, not with the tiny profile he'd given them. He watched as several men stepped out of the doorway next to Kent and his 3 subordinates. In the middle of the group was a huge figure. Court thought the man must have been at least 6'6", and he carried a smaller man who was clearly either dead or unconscious over his shoulder. Court assumed him to be the prisoner he'd last seen on the Gulf Stream a few hours earlier. There were nearly a dozen men plus the prisoner at the other end of the hall, but the group immediately turned to the left, away from Court, and they began walking towards a doorway that Court assumed led to the western side of the property. The 4 who'd been in the hallway turned to follow them. The sound of the helicopter spinning up again filled Court's earplugs, forcing him to shut them off. Court decided to get a look at the tail number of the helo. To do so, he could either pursue the men or find a window on the southwestern side of the building that would give him a vantage point to the area outside the west wing. This meant crossing the hall, and he knew he couldn't wait for the group to leave to do it, because if he couldn't get eyes on the helo from here, he'd have to take the time to find another vantage point. He quickly glanced across the hall, still listening to the sounds of the men walking away off to his right. He looked to the left for any flashlight beam that would alert him to a sentry, but it was too dark to see into the stairwell across and to his left. The hallway floor between court and the room on the other side looked clean of obstructions, so he began moving slowly and silently. On his third step across the hall, he heard a sudden noise to his left. The echo of footsteps on the tile at the bottom of the stairs was unmistakable. And the footsteps were quickly followed by a voice.
"Bloody torch is dead. We pull it out now?"
Court turned to see the silhouette of a man approaching through the dimness, a rifle held low in his arms. Quickly, the sentry's gun began to rise, so Court swung his suppressed pistol up and fired twice. The Ruger made a quiet but easily audible thump-thump sound, and the ejecting brass from the weapon clinked along the floor, echoing down the length of the hallway. The sentry fell back in a heap on the stairs. 100 feet behind Court, 11 men turned in the direction of the echoes. A flashlight's beam shone on him even before he began moving again for the room across the hall. He took off in a sprint, then dove into the room and crashed into an upturned desk just as a pair of gunshots pounded the thick air behind him. Chapter 13. Kent had fired one of the two rounds, but he was certain both he and Davy had missed the target moving through the dusty dim.
"Get him!"
Two of Kent's men began running up the hall, flashlights in one hand and pistols in the other, but Fox shouted at Kent as he and his group hustled in the other direction.
"All of you go after him! He cannot leave here alive!"
Kent turned away and followed the rest of his men up the hall, staying far to the back of the pack.
"Everyone move to the south side, ground floor, east of the entry. One subject, take him out, but watch your crossfire!"
Kent didn't want to get shot by his own men any more than he wanted to get shot by the hostel. Court's grand scheme to learn something about the Hilo went up in smoke as his opposition began getting word from their leader that an interloper was inside the wire. He knew men would be collapsing on him now from all over this massive old hospital, so he raced back to the east through doorways that connected the administration office to a long narrow room lined with broken file cabinets. His goal was to get back down to the tunnel, but basement access was on the far side of the east wing, and he had a lot of ground to cover. He pumped the air with his arms as he sprinted, his SIG pistol in his right hand and his red headlamp shining on his forehead so he could see his way forward, even though it could be seen easily by others in the darkness. He heard the helicopter behind him lifting into the sky, but there wasn't a damn thing he could do about the captured banker. Instead, he just kept running for his life. He sprinted to a doorway, raising his handgun when he heard the squawk of a radio on the other side. Court knew that with the light on his head and the noise generated on the flooring by his frantic pace, he wasn't likely any stealthier than whoever was in the next room with a walkie-talkie blaring, and the man there would hear his footsteps even if he did not yet know if Court was friend or foe. Court moved to the wall, dropped to his knees, and quickly spun into the doorway, mindful of the sound of others approaching from behind him. Just feet away, he saw a man with a bloody dressing on his thigh, and the man saw him at the same time. The gunman lifted his submachine gun and pointed it in Court's direction. Court fired, dropping the man onto his back with two rounds to the chest. Up and running again, he had not made it far at all before he heard more gunfire, close and on his left. The wall next to him began to pock with bullet holes, fired from the other side by an automatic weapon. Plaster and paint sprayed across the glow of his red headlamp's light. This forced Court down into a crouch as he ran. He returned fire blindly into the wall, then felt a powerful tug nearly toppling him. He was certain he'd been hit at first, but quickly realized his backpack had taken a bullet instead of his body. More bursts of fire chased him back across the hall in the east wing, and then, when he made the turn to head towards the stairs to the basement, he found himself facing down another pair of men with flashlights and guns just a dozen feet away. As gunfire pounded his ears, Court dove to the dusty floor of the abandoned building, sliding on his hip towards the gunman. He took one down like a bowling pin as they collided, then shot the second man three times as he spun and took aim on Court's prone body. The sentry on the ground with him had lost control of his gun, and it fell away, but he quickly pulled a short, hooked, fixed blade knife out of a sheath on his belt and drove it down at Court's face, while Court still had his weapon pointed in the direction of the other enemy. Court parried the first strike with his left hand, and the man knocked Court's gun arm back and lurched to stab again. Court rolled quickly onto his stomach. The knife cut through the air above him, and then the blade slammed into the backpack, burying itself into a plastic bottle of water. Now Court rolled onto his backpack, bringing his left arm out as he whirled back around, and he executed a spinning back fist that connected with the jaw of the man above him. With the thunk of bone on flesh, the man's head snapped to the side, a tooth flew out of his mouth ahead of a spray of blood, and he slumped to his side on top of his dead colleague. Court rose to his feet as more men approached from behind. He fired back behind him as he ran the opposite way, quickly getting himself out of the line of fire by racing into the stairwell down to the basement. As he entered the tunnel to the mortuary seconds later, he could hear the footsteps and shouts of what sounded like at least a half dozen men running through the basement behind him. He ran in a crouch through the tunnel, using his red light freely now, a necessity to avoid tripping through the trash-filled water or banging his head on pipes hanging from the ceiling that ran the length of the passageway. He knew that in moments there would be bullets racing through the narrow shaft and he'd be a fish in a barrel, so he pulled off his pack, yanked out the grenade launcher, and spun back around. He dropped to his knees in the murky sludge just as the first flashlight beam shone on him, and he raised the weapon. A crack of unsuppressed gunfire, the ping of a bullet hitting a pipe feet from Court's head, and then Court pulled the trigger, arcing a 40-millimeter grenade back up the small tunnel to the entrance to the basement. With a jarring boom and a ball of fire, it detonated, and Court was back up and running again, reloading the single-shot break-open barrel weapon, this time with a tear gas round. He made it all the way to the mortuary end of the tunnel before the gunfire behind him resumed, and here he dropped again into the ankle-deep water, spun back, and fired the launcher once more. The tear gas round didn't generate the sound or the flash of the high-explosive shell, but he knew it would make the poorly ventilated, claustrophobic tunnel impassable for the next hour or so. When it detonated halfway down the passage, he raced up the stairs into the post-mortem room of the mortuary, then ran through the building, throwing his M320 back into his wet pack and retrieving his pistol from his waistband. He exited through a window of the mortuary, then sprinted for the woods with his gun, shifting left to right with his eyes as he scanned for targets, unsure if anyone was up at ground level with eyes on him. A minute later, he was back on the little pit bike, racing through the woods at a breakneck pace. He was aware that the men behind him were in possession of two vehicles that could run him down in seconds, and the last thing he was going to do was buzz out onto the highway on top of this two-wheel toy. He needed a car, and he knew where to get one. As he'd flown over the area most of an hour earlier, he'd spied a golf course with a parking lot adjacent. It was just on the eastern side of the forest, so he took his bike all the way to the woodline, then ran from there onto the property. He climbed a fence, dropped down into the parking lot, then crouched between cars while he watched a lone valet near the entrance to the clubhouse. An older man with a set of clubs on his shoulders stepped up to the valet and handed him a ticket, and then the young man grabbed a key out of a box next to him and began running off into the lot. Court had spent dozens of hours watching valets in his career, and as was